Ladies and gentlemen, I must first thank your president for inviting me to be guest of honour at the Society's annual dinner. And I know I speak for Alison too in thanking you for your generous hospitality. The downside of this is that I have to sing for my supper. On second thoughts, I'll spare you that. I'll talk instead. As I'm sure most of you know, I was all set to do this last year when the heavens opened and put paid to the reunion and much else in the Team Valley. As it happened, Alison and I were in our camper van looking at properties around the Hereford area, and indeed saw the house that we now live in for the very first time on the day of what I describe as the Midlands monsoon. Fortunately, we were moored overnight on high ground, but driving around the county, ploughing through flooded roads, was not a particularly pleasant experience. You all must have shared with me the déjà vu feeling earlier this month when we saw pictures of the Keir Brook flooding again. Thank goodness it was not on the scale of last year. When William asked if he could rebook me for the 2008 reunion, I accepted, thinking that what I'd prepared to say last year would work perfectly well this year. Wrong. What I didn't know then was that by the time September 2008 came round, I would have retired from St George's Chapel in Windsor Castle after 23 years there. There is a certain tidiness about leaving the profession now. It's 50 years since I left the choir of Winchester Cathedral as a chorister. It's 45 years since I went up to Cambridge on an organ scholarship. 40 years since I was appointed assistant organist at Ely. And 35 years since I arrived here at St Michael's. So what I have to say this evening comes from the very personal perspective of someone on the staff at the college for close on 13 years. To say that they were remarkable years would be to understate the case considerably. But during that time, I found myself working daily with a fascinating collection of boys and their parents, a wonderfully eclectic collection of colleagues on the staff, and kind and welcoming people in the wider St Michael's community. My piano and organ students smile indulgently when I use, as I often do, the word connections. But I can't escape the concept. There have been so very many connections in my musical life, and my time at St Michael's has had its fair share. I suppose I was first conscious of something called St Michael's College, Tenbury Wells, when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge. I seem to remember the rather exotically named Lucian Nethsinger playing organ recitals on the third programme of BBC Radio, and coming back to King's College, where he'd been a music scholar, and playing in the chapel. And I also remember hearing choral evensong broadcast from St Michael's at fairly regular intervals. Soon after Cambridge, I spent 4 years as assistant organist at Ely, where one of my colleagues on the staff of the King's School played me the Decca Argo recording that Lucian made with the choir here in the 1960s. The review in the Gramophone magazine tells you all you need to know. The performances are absolutely first class, in short, a winner. A number of years later, the son of that Ely colleague joined the choir of St Michael's in its final years. I loved that recording, and when, in 1972, I heard on the organist's bush telegraph that Lucian was moving to Exeter Cathedral, I was sure that I should apply for the position here. By that time, I discovered that St Michael's College had a fine reputation in the world of church music, and the fact that Lucian was moving to an important cathedral position proved to me that it held an important place in the business of cathedral and church music. My interview was conducted in the dining hall, with the great and the good of the college governing body seated along the back of the high table, with me facing them alone on the other side of the table. Today we would describe this as rather adversarial, if not downright intimidating. In fact, rather Alan Sugar. There's only one thing about the interview that I remember with complete clarity. when the grilling stopped, in the way that interviewing panels do, I was asked whether there was anything I would like to ask them. I thought for a moment and said, "Could you tell me something about the college's financial state?" I think it's fair to say that that took them somewhat by surprise. There was quite a pause, nervous looks up and down the table, before Harry Pitt, the chairman of the governing body, said, "Well, let's say you won't be joining a sinking ship." Perhaps it just had a slow puncture. I arrived at the college in January 1973 and quickly realised my good fortune. Lucian had left behind an excellently well-trained choir that was ready and keen to accept and adopt the ideas of a new boy. There were some delightful boys and some equally splendid men. I should go off script here because I remembered the other day that one of the boys, I can't remember his first name, Mead, but he had the most amazing father, who owned a helicopter hire business. No, it was the older one.
Edward.
Thank you. And he was prone to drop in on the Sunday by helicopter. This was extremely exhausting. But there were also some equally splendid men in the choir. And I was fascinated by one of the altos, who appeared to be from a different age. Cycling to and from the college, and after evensong in the winter months, lighting up acetylene lamps for his remarkable collection of antique bicycles. Brian De Morse. For of course it was he, just the sort of person that every prep school should have. And what a delight to find him and Nora on our table. When I arrived at St Michael's, I was driving an open-topped MG. Well, at least it was open-topped in decent weather. So Brian's love of old cars struck a chord. But his were far older and far more rare than mine. I confess that I thought he took things just a little too far with his typewriters. I recall that he won a national competition when it was proved that the typewriter he used on a daily basis was the oldest one being so used in the UK. The prize, I seem to remember, was an electronic beast. At that time, two singers in the choir, in the back rows, were not members of the staff. Vincent Petley was singing tenor when I arrived, but after a year or two dropped down to sing baritone until his retirement in 1981, after 27 years, wonderful service. He was a very supportive colleague and a tower of strength in the choir. George Coles was the proverbial legend in his own lifetime, and I had the great privilege to speak in his honour when we celebrated his 50th year in the choir. Those of you who understand the organ will know what I mean when I say that his voice was like a well-voiced organ pedal pipe. That underpin the musical's texture, whether it's loud or soft. That he was such an extraordinarily nice man was a great bonus. No choir director could ask for a better or more loyal colleague. He also gave the lie to the old adage that you couldn't teach an old dog new tricks. He was well up for new ideas. And he was supported, of course, by the wonderful Mary. And their kindness and hospitality was legendary. She was one of those people who told you just exactly the way things were. You were never left in any doubt what she felt about anything. She was a most perceptive critic and, as they say, knew what she liked. Woe betide the organist if he played some music by Olivier Messiaen after the service without warning her first, so that she could take avoiding action by staying at home. The warden of the college in 1973 was Dennis Paxman, and he and his wife Jenny made the new boy very welcome, and they were both marvellously supportive of my initiatives. Added to which, we shared a love of the traditional pub and its beer. Evening excursions to Bishop's Castle and the Three Tuns there, where they brewed their own beer, soon became regular occurrences. Dennis, too, was an inveterate recording enthusiast and had a top-of-the-range reel-to-reel tape machine. When in their sitting room, one was just as likely to be regaled with a favourite Bach cantata from his complete connection taken from BBC Radio 3 broadcasts, as with one of the complete collection of goon shows, most of which he knew from memory, all played on their custom-built hi-fi setup. In chapel, Dennis took the services impeccably. His reading of the lessons was a model of clarity. One vital aspect of choral services is the intoning of the responses and prayers, and I seem to recall that seldom, if at all, did he cause the master of music a moment's concern. It's such a joy that he, Jenny, and Tori are here today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Helping Dennis in church and around the parish was a retired priest, Keith Flint, who'd served some of his priesthood on the island of Tristan da Cunha before volcanic eruptions caused the island to be evacuated. I was told very firmly never, ever accept a lift in his car. I have it on very good authority that he would get into his car, switch the engine on, and then say, "Over to you, God." There were times on the narrow lanes around St. Michael's when God was awfully busy. On the college staff was another remarkable man, Roger Nichols. He was, indeed still is, a brilliant musician, and it was my good fortune that he was able to accompany the choir in some of its concerts, because then we didn't have an assistant organist, so if services were accompanied, then I played the organ and the choir got on with it, and anything unaccompanied I would trundle downstairs to conduct. But in concerts you can't really do that, so Roger was a wonderful support, and he also masterminded a series of summer concerts that the college hosted for a number of years. And his real job was to teach classics, which he did for 7 years before leaving to start on an increasingly distinguished career as a major contributor to Radio 3. There, his distinctive voice continues to bring pleasure and erudition in equal measure to many, and also writing brilliant biographical articles for the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, and full-scale biographies of some of the great names of 20th century French composers. You may be interested to know that he was recently commissioned by Yale University Press to write a new biography of Maurice Ravel. That is the quality of the man. He also taught at the Open University, Birmingham, and Oxford universities. Alison and I were privileged to be at the French ambassador's residence in London last year when the honour of Chevalier de Légion d'Honneur was bestowed on him by the ambassador on behalf of the French government in a large company of his friends and colleagues, a richly deserved award indeed. In my early years at the college, I was made more aware of the significance of the college in the musical life of the church generally. Discovering that John Stainer, sometime organist of St. Paul's Cathedral, had been one of the first organists here when still a teenager, and Walter Parrott had been a pupil of Ouseley and organist at Great Whitley, from where he used to walk to Tenbury for breakfast across the fields several times a week. Another connection: Parrott was for over 40 years organist at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. Whilst at St. Michael's, I was able to re-establish a link with the Baroque church at Whitley Court, where Parrott had been organist. Later organists had moved to Westminster Abbey, Norwich Cathedral, Suffolk Minster, and this knowledge added to my feeling that this was a good place to be. I had the good fortune to get to know Christopher Robinson, who was down the road at Worcester Cathedral. I was frequently over there picking his brains and being given valuable and sensible advice to this newcomer to the business of choir training and management. That colleague at Ely I mentioned earlier had also introduced me to a recording of Elgar's church music, brilliantly performed by Christopher and his Worcester choir. 40 years later, it is still on sale, now transferred to CD. His appointment to St George's Chapel from Worcester was greeted with dismay by everyone with any musical connections in the Three Choirs triangle. Quite coincidentally, at about the time of Christopher's move from the Severn Valley, there was an important arrival in the Wye Valley. Roy Massey came to be organist at Hereford Cathedral and quickly became an important friend of the college and personally a valuable ally and support. We started singing a joint evensong alternately at the cathedral and at the college and doing concerts together. These were musically and socially a great success and widened our network of followers considerably. Roy was only too ready to come over to the college and accompany the choir when we broadcast evensong or made one of our recordings, and it was always a pleasure working with him. He also had the happy idea of involving St Michael's as a musical outpost of the Hereford Three Choirs Festival. Like Christopher, Roy was made a fellow of the college and took a keen interest in all that we did. One aspect of college life that I found endlessly fascinating was the library, and I enjoyed having a set of library keys which let me into the strongroom whenever I liked. I was invested with the title of Honorary Assistant Librarian and had the happy task of looking after visiting researchers from literally all over the world. There were some amusing moments, like when a scholar from the USA, who at Paddington Station asked for a train ticket for Tenbury, said, sadly, he was at least 20 years out of date. Then there was the slightly more prepared scholar who brought his bicycle and cycled from Worcester, arriving in a state, it was the height of summer, which I will leave you to imagine. It was a thrill that never diminished to open books that Handel had handled, that Purcell would have used, and that singers contemporary with Bird, Gibbons and Tomkins would have used to sing their music. But it was even more special to share these things with the boys of the choir. It brought history alive in a unique way. The Library Visitors Book was an extraordinary document too, with some great names amongst its pages. I especially recall the signatures of Imogen Holst, the daughter of Gustav, Peter Piers and Benjamin Britten, who visited St Michael's when Britten was making a new edition of St Purcell for the Aldborough Festival. And I remember showing Sir Charles Mackerras Handel's conducting score of Messiah. He drove up to Tenbury for the day when he was conducting Beethoven's Fidelio at the Welsh National Opera in Cardiff. Then there was that glorious harpsichord by Shudi and Broadwood, which, like the manuscripts, could bring the musical history alive in a tangible way. Made in 1773, Bach had been dead 23 years, Handel 14, Haydn was 41 years old, Mozart was 17 years old, and Beethoven a mere 3. I also recall making myself rather unpopular with the powers that be when they decided to sell the harpsichord. I remember being told very firmly that it was of little importance to the life of the college. I, however, felt that it was things like the harpsichord that helped give the college its special appeal and helped to make it the place that it was. But of course, what really made St Michael what it was, and why it still has such a strong following amongst those who experienced life at the college, as this evening and today shows, were the boys, and latterly the girls, and their families. Families who were incredibly supportive of the college and the choir, and many of whom have become good and lasting friends of those who worked there. Naturally, I had a particular rapport with the boys in the choir, as I was working with them for significant periods each day. But being such a close-knit community, everyone counted. I hope that I can say this without seeming too self-satisfied, but one thing that gives me great joy is that the knowledge that some of my students have wanted to go on and pursue a career in music after I finished with them. There are singers, music teachers, school directors of music. One who was until recently an associate professor of music at the University of Chicago and is now back at Oxford University as a university lecturer in ethnomusicology and a fellow of St. John's College there. St. Michael's also enjoyed the services of a number of gap year students, either singing in the choir or as organ scholars, and they have notched up some significant achievements. Stephen Carpenter is now the managing director of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Chris Chivers is a canon of Blackburn Cathedral and doing groundbreaking work in interfaith tolerance between Muslims and Christians. Julian McNamara is director of music at the Oratory School in Reading, and Paul Brough, director of music at All Saints Margaret Street in London and music director of the Hanover Band. One especial joy of life in St. Michael's was, and indeed miraculously still is, the glorious Father Willis organ. It was wonderful to hear it again this afternoon. To play this instrument day after day, both as an accompaniment to the choir and solo, was a huge privilege, and one that I probably took for granted far too easily. It has a sound so perfectly matched to the building, and more importantly, to accompany the choir, that is almost unrivalled. It gives me a thrill to play it still, and very fortunately, every now and again, I'm asked to come back and play a concert on it. Now that we live just a short step down the road by Hereford, perhaps there will be more opportunities to play here. I mentioned John Stainer as an early organist of the college. I'm pleased to tell you that in the not too distant future, I'm recording a CD of his organ music here. Although the present organ was rebuilt after Stainer's time, Willis used so much of the previous instrument that there is a great deal that Stainer would recognise, so I think the music and the organ will go very much hand in hand. Earlier, I mentioned the wider community at St. Michael's. When I arrived in 1973, the hamlet was greatly enriched by the presence of V and Peter Welsby, the genial hosts of the Doghouse. And there, on many an evening, I got to meet and know some of the people who lived and worked around St. Michael's. Further down the road were Kath and Doug Powis, Kath giving great service to the community, keeping the post office alive, and Doug keeping my ancient NGs in working fettle where others might have given up on them. Jo Goldsborough, the widow of Arnold Goldsborough, who a fine musicologist and founder of the Goldsborough Chamber Orchestra, which then on his death became the English Chamber Orchestra, lived in the parish. Tony and Janet Penn, the Robinsons, Andrew Dunn, and Tony Parkin, for many years the agricultural advisor to the Archers, all made life at St. Michael's such an agreeable and varied experience. And I'm happy to say that some of these friendships made all those years ago thrive to this day. Early on, I mentioned connections. I was a chorister at Winchester Cathedral, where the organist was the wonderfully named Alwyn Surplus. He sent his eldest son to St. Michael's as a chorister during the Second World War, and he himself was a predecessor of mine as assistant organist at St. George's. Christopher Robinson became a good friend whilst I was here, a friendship that turned into a musical partnership at exactly the moment when I was out of a job in the autumn of 1985, and when St. George's Chapel found itself without an assistant organist suddenly and in the most tragic of circumstances. That move created another connection, because I was then working in the organ loft that Walter Parrott had presided over for 40 years following his apprenticeship to Ouseley here. When I first arrived at St. George's, I lived in a flat a 10-minute walk from the castle, and the other occupant of the building was Freddie Hodgson, who was a retired alto lay clerk from St. George's Chapel. Guess what? he had been a lay clerk at St. Michael's. Yet another connection. We had many a long and fascinating conversation about his short time here. It was only four terms. But that time made a deep impression on him. And many decades later, he wrote affectionately of the college and of some of the personalities he encountered in a delightful reminiscence called Choirs and Cloisters. Freddie went on to sing at Lincoln and Lichfield before going to Windsor. So when he said that the standard of music making at Tenbury was very high, he knew what he was talking about. I have now retired from salaried work, and although I hope I shall be able to play the organ and the piano for many more years, the idea that I've reached the end of my formal working life is a rather strange and disturbing notion, I have to say. I've been a very fortunate man in my chosen work. I've been paid, often not very well, for doing what I love. I've lived in some lovely places, had the run of some wonderful, beautiful buildings, played many glorious instruments, but best of all, I've had the privilege of making music with some great choirs, and nothing has been more satisfying than the 12 years spent in this glorious part of the country and my time at St. Michael's. For 40 years, I've been intimately involved with the Psalms, accompanying or directing them daily. They are the most remarkable resource imaginable. You can find words to suit pretty much every situation. I think mine is best summed up in Psalm 16. The lot is fallen unto me in a fair ground. Yea, I have a goodly heritage.